This is primarily a mental attitude or condition, so that its result must be looked for in the mental realm. As it is an intensification of the personality, at the expense of the individuality, one of its results will undoubtedly be the accentuation of the lower personality, so that the selfishness tends to reproduce itself in aggravated form, and to grow steadily stronger. This, of course, is part of the general workings of karmic law, and emphasizes how fatal a bar to progress is persistence in the fault of selfishness. For nature's severest penalty is always deprivation of the opportunity for progress, just as her highest reward is the offering of such opportunity. When a man rises to a level somewhat higher than that of the ordinary man, and his principal activity becomes mental, there is danger lest he should identify himself with the mind. He should therefore strive to identify himself with the ego, and make the ego the strongest point of his consciousness, thus merging the personality in the individuality. The student should strive to realize that the mind is not the knower, but the instrument that the knower uses to obtain knowledge. To identify the mind with the knower is similar to identifying the chisel with the sculptor who wields it. The mind limits the knower, who, as self-consciousness develops, finds himself hampered by it on every side. As a man may put on thick gloves and find that he thereby loses a great deal in delicacy of touch, so it is with the knower when he puts on the mind. The hand is within the glove, but its capacities are greatly lessened, so the knower is present within the mind, but his powers are limited in their expression. As we saw in a previous chapter, the mental body possesses the characteristic of actually shaping a portion of itself into a likeness of the object presented to it. When it is thus modified, the man is said to know the object. What he knows, however, is not the object itself, but the image produced by the object in his own mental body. This image, moreover, for reasons which we have already discussed, cp. 56, is not a perfect reproduction of the object, but is liable to be colored and distorted by the characteristics of the particular mind in which it is formed. These considerations bring home to us that, in our minds or mental bodies, we do not know things in themselves, but only the images of them which are produced in our consciousness. Meditation on these ideas will help the student to realize ever more and more fully that he himself, the true individuality, is not the personality which he, as the ego, has temporarily assumed for this one earth life. The existence of an evil quality in the personality implies a lack of the corresponding good quality in the ego or individuality. An ego may be imperfect, but he cannot be evil, nor, in any ordinary circumstances, can evil of any kind manifest through the causal body. The mechanical reason for this has been explained previously. Evil qualities can be expressed only in the four lower subdivisions of astral matter. These reflect their influence in the mental plane only on its four lower subdivisions, hence they cannot affect the ego at all. The only emotions that can appear in the three higher astral subplanes are good ones, such as love, sympathy and devotion. These affect the ego in the causal body, since he resides on the corresponding subplanes of the mental world. The utmost result that is brought about in the causal body by long-continued lives of a low type is a certain incapacity to receive the opposite good impression for a very considerable period afterwards, a kind of numbness or paralysis of the causal matter, an unconsciousness which resists impressions of the good of the opposite kind. The qualities which the ego develops thus cannot be other than good qualities. When they are well defined, they show themselves in each of his numerous personalities, and consequently those personalities can never be guilty of the vices opposite to such qualities. But where there is a gap in the ego, there is nothing inherent in the personality to check the growth of the opposite vice, and since others in the world about him already possess that vice, and since man is an imitative animal, it is quite probable that the vice will speedily manifest in him. The vice, however, as we have seen, belongs to the vehicles of the personality, not to the man inside them. In these vehicles its repetition may set up a momentum which is difficult to conquer, but if the ego bestirs himself to create in himself the opposite virtue, then the vice is cut off at its root, and can no longer exist, neither in this life nor in all the lives to come. In other words, The principle to be applied in practical life is, that to rid oneself of an evil quality in such a way that it can never reappear, is to fill the gap in the ego by developing the opposite virtue. Many modern schools of psychology and education now advocate this method rather than at attacking an evil quality in a more direct fashion. Nervous with constant affirmatives, said Emerson, with great insight. The personality is a mere fragment of the ego projecting but a minute portion of himself into the mental, astral, and physical bodies. This tiny fragment of consciousness can be seen by clairvoyants moving about within man. Sometimes it is seen as the golden man the size of a thumb, who dwells in the heart. Others see it as a brilliant star of light. A man may keep this star of consciousness where he will, that is, in any one of the seven chakrams of the body. Which of these chakrams is most natural depends largely upon the type or ray of the man, and also, it seems, upon his race and sub-race. Thus men of the fifth sub-race of the fifth root race nearly always keep that consciousness in the brain, in the chakram dependent upon the pituitary body. There are, however, men of other races who keep it habitually in the heart, the throat, or the solar plexus. The star of consciousness is the representative of the ego in the lower planes, is in fact, what we know as the personality. But although, as we have seen, that personality is part of the ego, its only life and power being that of the ego, it nevertheless often forgets those facts and comes to regard itself as an entirely separate entity, and works for its own ends. In the case of ordinary people who have never studied these matters, the personality is to all intents and purposes the man, the ego manifesting himself only very rarely and partially. There is always a line of communication between the personality and the ego, this is called antakarana. Most people make no effort to use this line. In its earlier stages, evolution consists in the opening up of this line of communication, so that the ego may be able increasingly to assert himself through it and finally to dominate the personality. When this is achieved, the personality has no separate thought or will, but becomes, as it should be, merely an expression of the ego on the lower planes. The hold that the ego has over his lower vehicles is only very partial, and the antakarana may be regarded as the arm stretched out between the little piece of the ego that is awakened, and the hand that is put down. When the two are perfectly joined, this attenuated thread ceases to exist. In Sanskrit, antakarana means the inner organ or instrument, and its destruction would imply that the ego would no longer need an instrument, but would work directly on the personality. Thus the antakarana, being the link between the higher and lower self, disappears when one will operates the two. It must, however, be understood that the ego, belonging as he does to an altogether higher plane, can never fully express himself in the lower planes. The most that can be expected is that the personality will contain nothing which is not intended by the ego, that it will express as much of him as can be expressed in the lower world. A man completely untrained has practically no communication with the ego. The initiate has full communication. Note, it would appear here that, as every other step on the occult path, initiation confers the possibility of full communication with the ego rather than its complete realization. The initiate must by his own efforts convert the possibility into an actuality. A. E. Powell, between these two extremes there are, of course, men at all stages. It must be borne in mind that the ego himself is in process of development, and we therefore have to deal with egos in very different stages of advancement. In any case, an ego is in many ways something enormously bigger than a personality can ever be. Although the ego himself is but a fragment of the monad, he is yet complete as an ego in his causal body even when his powers are undeveloped, whereas in the personality there is but a touch of the life of the ego. It is obviously of great importance that the earnest student should do all in his power to make and keep active the connection between his personality and his ego. In order to do this, he must pay attention to life, for the paying attention is the descent of the ego in order to look through his vehicles. Many men have fine mental bodies and good brains, but they make little use of them, because they do not pay attention to life. Thus the ego puts but little of himself down into the lower planes, and so the vehicles are left to run right at their own will. The cure for this, very briefly, is as follows. The ego should be given the conditions he desires. If this is done, he will promptly put himself down more fully and avail himself of the conditions offered. Thus, if he desires to develop affection, the personality must provide the opportunity for developing affection to the fullest extent on the lower planes. If he desires wisdom, then the personality must by study endeavor to make itself wise on the physical plane. Pains should be taken to find out what the ego desires. Then, if the necessary conditions are provided, he will appreciate the effort and be delighted to respond. The personality will have no cause to complain of the response which the ego will make. In other words, if the personality pays attention to the ego will pay attention to the personality. The ego puts down a personality much as a fisherman makes a cast. He does not expect that every cast will be successful, and he is not deeply troubled if one proves a failure. To look after a personality is only one of his activities, so he may very well console himself with successes in other lines of activity. In any case, failure represents the loss of a day, and he can hope to do better with another day. Often the personality would like more attention from the ego, and he may be sure he will receive it as soon as he deserves it, as soon as the ego finds it worthwhile. In the Christian Church, the sacrament of confirmation is intended to widen and strengthen the link between the ego and the personality. After the preliminary widening of this channel, the divine power rushes through the ego of the bishop into the higher manas of the candidate. At the signing of the cross, it pushes upwards into the Buddhic principle, and from there into the Atma or spirit. The effect upon Atma is reflected in the etheric double, that upon the Buddhi is reproduced in the astral body. And what is done to the higher manas should be similarly mirrored in the lower mind. This result is not merely temporary, for the opening up of the connections made a wider channel through which a constant flow can be kept going. The general effect, as said, is to make it easier for the ego to act on and through his vehicles. The various vehicles of man, looked at from below, give the impression of being one above the other, although they are not, of course, really separated in space, and also of being joined by innumerable fine wires or lines of fire. Every action which works against evolution puts an unequal strain upon these, twisting and entangling them. When a man goes badly wrong in any way, the confusion between the higher and lower bodies is seriously impeded. He is no longer his real self, and only the lower side of his character is able to manifest itself fully. The Christian Church provides a method of assisting man more rapidly to regain uniformity. For one of the powers specially conferred upon a priest-ordained ordination is that of straightening out this triangle in higher matter. This is the truth behind absolution, the cooperation of the man having been first obtained by confession. A break in the connection between the ego and his vehicles results in insanity. If we imagine each physical particle in the brain is to be joined to its corresponding astral particle by a small tube, each astral particle being similarly joined to its corresponding mental particle, and each mental particle to its corresponding causal particle, then so long as all these tubes are in perfect alignment there will be a clear communication between the ego and his brain. But if any of the sets of tubes be bent, closed, or knocked partially aside, it is obvious that the communication might be wholly or partially interrupted. From the occult standpoint, the insane may be divided into four main classes, as follows: 1. Those who are insane from a defect in the physical brain. The brain may be too small, injured by some accident, pressed upon by a growth, or have its tissues softened. 2. Those whose defect is in the etheric brain, so that the etheric particles do not correspond with the denser physical particles. 3. Those in whom the astral body is defective, the tubes being out of alignment with either the etheric or mental particles. 4. Those in whom the mental body is out of order. Classes 1 and 2 are quite sane when out of the body and sleep, and of course after death. Class 3 do not recover sanity until the heaven world is reached. Class 4. Do not become sane until the causal body is reached, so that for this class the incarnation is a failure. More than 90% of the insane belong to classes 1 and 2. Obsession is caused by the ousting of the ego by some other entity. Only an ego who had a weak hold on his vehicles would permit obsession. Although the hold of the ego upon his vehicles is less strong in childhood, yet adults are more likely to be obsessed than children, because the adult is far more likely to have in him qualities which attract undesirable entities and make obsession easy. Briefly, the best way to prevent obsession is by the use of the will. If the lawful possessor of the body will confidently assert himself and use his willpower, no obsession can take place. When obsession occurs, it is almost always because the victim has in the first place voluntarily yielded himself to the invading influence, and his first step, therefore, is to reverse the act of submission and determine strongly to resume control over his own property. The relationship between the personality and the ego is so important that we may perhaps be pardoned for a little repetition, or recapitulation. A study of the inner vehicles of man should at least help us to understand that it is the higher presentation which is the real man, not the aggregation of physical matter in the midst of it, to which men are apartment to attach such undue importance. The divine trinity within we may not yet see, but we can at least attain some idea of the causal body, which is perhaps the nearest to a conception of the true man as sight at the higher mental level can give us. Looking at the man from the lower mental level, we can see only so much of him as can be expressed in his mental body. On the astral level we find that an additional veil has descended, whilst on the physical plane there is yet another barrier, so that the true man is more effectively hidden than ever. Such knowledge should lead us to form a somewhat higher opinion of our fellows, since we realize that they are so much more than they seem to the physical eye. In the background, there is always the higher possibility, and often an appeal to the better nature will arouse it from latency and bring it down into manifestation where we can see it. Having thus studied man as he is, it becomes easier for us to pierce through the dense physical veil and image the reality which is behind. That which is behind all men is the divine nature. Hence, grasping this principle, we should be able so to modify and readjust our attitude that we are able to help other men better than we could do without this knowledge. We have already seen, in the chapter on contemplation, that the consciousness of the ego may be reached by maintaining the mind in an attitude of attention, without the attention being directed to anything, the lower mind being stilled in order that consciousness of the higher mind may be experienced. By this means, ideas from the ego flashed down into the lower mind with dazzling light, these being the inspirations of genius. Behold, in every manifestation of genius, when combined with virtue, the undeniable presence of the celestial exile, the divine ego whose jailer thou art, O man of matter. Genius is thus the momentary grasping of the brain by the larger consciousness of the ego, who is the real man. It is the putting down of the larger consciousness into an organism capable of vibrating in answer to its thrills. Flashes of genius are the voice of the living spirit in man. They are the voice of the inner God, speaking in the body of man. The phenomena included in the term conscience appear to be of two distinct kinds. Conscience is sometimes used to describe the voice of the ego, and at other times it is spoken of as the will in the domain of morality. Where it is the voice of the ego, it should be recognized that it is not always infallible, but may often decide wrongly. For the ego cannot speak with certainty on problems with which it is unfamiliar, being dependent upon experience before he can judge correctly. That form of conscience, however, which comes from the will does not tell us what to do, but rather commands us to follow that which we already know to be best, usually when the mind is trying to invent some excuse to do otherwise. It speaks with the authority of the spiritual will, determining our path in life. But the will, which is undoubtedly a quality of the ego, must not be confused with the desires of the personality in the lower vehicles. Desire is the outgoing energy of the thinker, determined in direction by the attraction of external objects. Will is the outgoing energy of the thinker, determined in direction by conclusions drawn by reason from past experiences, or by the direct intuition of the thinker himself. In other words, desire is guided from without, will from within. In the early stages of evolution, desire has complete sovereignty, and hurries a man hither and thither. The man is ruled by his astral body, In the middle stages of evolution, there is continual conflict between desire and will. The man struggles with karma manas. In the later stages of evolution, desire dies, and will rules unopposed. The ego is in command. Summarizing, we may say that the voice of the ego or higher self speaking, 1, from Atma, is true conscience, 2, from Buddhi, is intuitive knowledge between right and wrong, 3, from higher manas, is inspiration. When inspiration becomes continuous enough to be normal, it is genius. As was briefly mentioned in Chapter 6, genius, which is of the ego, sees instead of arguing. True intuition is one of its faculties, as reason is the method of the lower mind. Intuition is simply insight. It may be described as the exercise of the eyes of the intelligence, the unerring recognition of a truth presented on the mental plane. It sees with certainty, but no reason proof of its certitude can be had, because it is beyond and above reason. But before the voice of the ego, speaking through intuition, can be recognized with certainty, careful and prolonged self-training are necessary. It would appear, however, that the word intuition is used with significations that vary somewhat. Thus, it has also been said that the attainment of reliable intuition in daily life means the opening of a direct channel between the buddhic and the astral bodies. Incidentally, it may be mentioned that it works rather through the heart center or chakram than through the mind. The consecration of a bishop has special reference to this center and to the stimulation of the intuition. We thus distinguish two distinct modes for the transmission of intuition from the higher to the lower consciousness. The one comes from the higher to the lower mental plane, the other direct from the body to the astral body. The intuition of the causal body has been described as the intuition which recognizes the outer, that which comes from buddhi is intuition which recognizes the inner. With buddhic intuition, one sees things from inside. With intellectual intuition, one recognizes something outside oneself. Which of these lines is the easier depends upon the method of individualization. Those who individualized through deep understanding will receive their intuition as a conviction, requiring no reasoning to establish its truth at present, though it must have been understood in previous lives or out of the body in the lower mental plane. Those who attained individualization through a rush of devotion will receive their intuition from the buddhic plane to the astral body. In both cases, of course, the condition of receptivity to intuition is a steadiness of the lower vehicles. We need not shrink from the fact that there is frequently a psychological instability associated with genius, as expressed in the saying that madness is akin to genius, and in the statement of Lombroso and others that many of the saints were neuropaths. Very often the saint and the visionary may have overstrained their brains, so that the physical mechanism is distorted and rendered unstable. Furthermore, it is sometimes true that the instability is the condition of the inspiration. As Professor William James has said, if there was such a thing as inspiration from a higher realm, it might well be that the neurotic temperament would furnish the chief condition of the requisite receptivity. Varieties of religious experience, p. 19. Genius may thus have an unstable brain because the higher consciousness is pressing upon it in order to improve the mechanism, so the brain is kept in a state of tension. And under such circumstances it may easily go too far until the structure breaks down under the strain. But the abnormality is on the right, not on the wrong side, being on the very front of the crest of human evolution. It is the instability of growth, not of disease. An attempt to stimulate the heart center is also made in the Christian church at the time of the reading of the gospel, the sign of the cross being made by the thumb over the heart center, as well as over those between the eyebrows and the throat. This use of the thumb corresponds to a pagan pass in mesmerism, and seems to be employed when a small but powerful stream of force is required, as for the opening of centers. The heart is the center and the body for the higher triad, Atma Buddhi Manas. The head is the seat of the psycho-intellectual man, its various functions being in 7 cavities, including the pituitary body and the pineal gland. A man who can take his consciousness from the brain to the heart should be able to unite karma manas to higher manas, through lower manas, which, when pure, is the antakarana. He will then be in a position to catch some of the promptings of the higher triad. In the Indian methods of yoga, Steps are taken to prevent the dangers of hysteria in those who are coming into touch with the higher planes, insistence being made upon discipline and purification of the body, and control and training of the mind. The ego frequently puts ideas into the lower consciousness in the form of symbols. Each ego has his own system of symbols, though some forms seem general in dreams. Thus, for example, it is said that to dream of water signifies trouble of some sort. Now, while there may be no real connection between water and troubles, yet if the ego knew that the personality held that particular belief with regard to water, he might very likely choose such a form of symbolism in order to warn the personality of some impending misfortune. In some cases, the ego may manifest himself in a curious external way. Thus, for example, Dr. Annie Besant has said that while she is speaking one sentence of a lecture, she habitually sees the next sentence actually materialize in the air before her, in three different forms, from which she consciously selects that one which she thinks best. This must be the work of the ego, though it is a little difficult to understand why he takes this particular method of communication instead of impressing his ideas direct on the physical brain. The relationship between the personality and the ego is graphically described in The Voice of the Silence. Have perseverance as one who doth forevermore endure. Thy shadows, i.e., personalities, live and vanish, that which in thee shall live forever, that which in thee knows, for it is knowledge, is not a fleeting life, it is the man that was, and will be, for whom the hour shall never strike. A vivid description of the ego is given also by H. P. Blavatsky in The Key to Theosophy. Try to imagine a spirit, a celestial being, whether we call it by one name or another, divine in its essential nature, yet not pure enough to be one with the All, and having, in order to achieve this, so to purify its nature as finally to gain that goal. It can do so only by passing, individually and personally, that is, spiritually and physically, through every experience and feeling that exists in the manifold or differentiated universe. It has, therefore, after having gained such experience in the lower kingdoms, and having ascended higher and still higher with every rung of the ladder of being, to pass through every experience on the human planes. In its very essence it is thought, and is, therefore, called in its plurality, Manasaputra, the sons of, universal, mind. This individualized thought is what we theosophists call the real human ego, the thinking entity imprisoned in a case of flesh and bones. This is surely a spiritual entity, not matter, that is, matter as we know it in the objective universe, and such entities are the incarnating egos that inform the bundle of animal matter called mankind, and whose names are manasa or minds. The ray of lower manas is ever seeking to return to its source and parent, the higher manas. But while the duality persists, that is, until the consciousness has been raised to the causal level, thereby unifying the higher and lower selves, as the phrase goes, there is a continual yearning, which is felt by the noblest and purest natures as one of the most salient facts of the inner life. It is this yearning which clothes itself as prayer, as inspiration, as seeking after God, as the longing for union with the divine. My soul is athirst for God, for the living God, cries the eager Christian. The occultist recognizes in this cry the inextinguishable impulse of the lower self to the higher self, from which it is separated, but the attraction of which it vividly feels. Whether a man prays to the Buddha, to Vishnu, to Christ, to the Virgin, to the Father, matters little. These are questions of dialect, not of fact. In every prayer the higher manas, united to Buddhi and to Atma, is the real objective, veiled under whatever name time or race may give. It is the ideal humanity, the personal God, the God-man, found in all religions. It is the God incarnate, the Word made flesh, the Christ who must be born in each, with whom the believer must be made one. Expressed rather more technically, the individualized God in each man, his Father in heaven, is the monad, and as the ego is to the monad, so is the personality to the ego. A warning hint, however, may here not be out of place. In the past, such expressions as looking up to the higher self, and listening to the promptings of the higher self, have been used, and it has even been suggested that the higher self ought to take more interest in the unfortunate personality struggling on its behalf on the lower planes. Gradually, the student should come to realize that the personality that we see on the lower planes is but a very small part of the real man, and that the higher self is the man.